Welcome back to yet another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens, below the line, with those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, the producers, the directors, the writers, the actors, the cinematographers, editors, film editors, sound mixers, costume designers, production designers, the masterful VFX artisans, composers, authors, you know it, you name them, we talk to them. A lot of talking going on of late. How many of you have gone out and picked up Scott Hoover's book, Beverly Hills Noir, yet? It's out there. It's a goodie. Pick it up. And we're in spooky season, and you all know how much I love spooky season. And we've had some good stuff happening, and some good movies the past few weeks we've been talking about. And today we're going to be talking with some wonderful filmmakers, two films that I'm crazy about. Number one, she should be calling in here momentarily, as I see the phone ringing now. Vivian Kerr is going to be joining us momentarily to talk about her new film, Seance. This is a real treat for me to speak with Vivian about Seance. I reviewed her first film a couple years ago, Scrap, and she did a wonderful job as writer-director. And now, her growth as a director from film one to film two, amazing, amazing. This is a great period piece and a wonderful actor. And a big shout out to her. Scotty Thompson is one of the four leads in it. And I'll see Scotty in anything. And she is so good in period pieces, which is what Seance is. And then, midpoint of the show, guys, you're going to get to see this one tomorrow on all the digital platforms, on VOD, satellite, Alien Country. We're going to have Rennie Grahams and Boston McConaughey with us to talk about Alien Country. It is an alien comedy with Demolition Derby, an alien taking human form, and he's named Ben. It is so much fun. So I can't wait for Rennie and Boston to join us. But first, let me go ahead and bring the wonderful Vivian Kerr live. Hi, Vivian.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. We got the right week this week.
I know. Yes, we did.
You're so anxious to talk to me about Seance. You jumped the gun last week. And that's
right. I'm just so excited about the film.
And you should be. I love this film. Love this film, Vivian. And number one, you've got Scotty. And I adore Scotty. She knows it. We have known each other for a number of years. She does period piece work so well. So you've got the wonderful Scotty Thompson as one of your four human characters. Being another one. And then you bring in Connor Paolo and Jalon Van Over. And that's it. That's the cast. And the story is so good. We've got husband number one, husband number two, ex-wife, dead child, hauntings. Let's have a seance.
Creepy dolls.
Very creepy dolls. And just incredible production design and set dress that really and costuming. That steep us in 1892. The dress that you wear as Lillian, number one, how heavy was that dress? And number two, it's beautiful.
It is beautiful. So I have to give a shout out to our costume designer, Nina Warwick, who's amazing. She actually works at the Albright, the Albright Fashion Institute. She has had an incredible career both in design and fashion, and she's brilliant. And that dress, well, it was very, very heavy. It actually was in two pieces and had a very heavy, thick petticoat underneath it. But we kept joking it was like, you know, like a Cinderella dress. It just had all these layers. But yeah, I thought it was stunning. It was a pleasure to wear something like that.
My God, the bodice with all of that heavy pearl beading on it.
Yeah,
just
amazing.
Oh, and the poofy sleeves, but then the beading carries onto there. Just gorgeous. And
yeah, I think she also made some slight alterations to it, but I can't remember. But same with Scotty's dress. I think she might have done a few small things to it, but they're... Yeah, they were both incredible, incredible pieces.
And Scotty's off-the-shoulder dress, because Scotty has a long neck, and she has a gorgeous neck and shoulders. So the dress, that green dress, just showcased her so beautifully. And then she had that great diamond choker, diamond necklace on.
Yeah, her necklace is beautiful.
Oh, I want that necklace. Just saying.
Yeah. Well, we really wanted to have us be sort of contrasting a little bit to each other,
yeah.
You know, so I'm sort of dressed a little bit more like a doll, sort of a little bit more like fragile. And her dress is a little more modern because she's sort of this woman ahead of her time, sort of ambitious female novelist. So we wanted the dresses to really suit the characters.
And they really do. Because when you look at the dress that you're wearing and you look at what some of the dolls of Lillian's deceased daughter, Hazel, you know, spread out in the room, that was very much the fashion with the poofier sleeve and short sleeves at that, not even long sleeves. So it really, and the blonde hair, and most of the dolls the camera lingers on have blonde hair. So,
yeah, that was definitely intentional.
Yeah.
That we talked about with our production designer, Bree Jones.
Yeah, so definitely you're more equated. There was a great differential. And with Scotty's dark hair and the green, I mean, just a gorgeous green, but both of you. And I love that you've got great shots at your DP. Joanna does such a great job of you going up and downstairs, especially downstairs, and the trains that trail the dresses, taking up seven or eight stairs. You're down here on the bottom stair, and seven or eight stairs, the dress is still coming.
You know, it's funny, though, that you brought that up, because that shot where we go downstairs into the basement to do the seance, we did really have to space ourselves out. There was, I think, a few takes where we were, like, tripping over each other.
And even with the nightgown, with Scotty's in a nightgown, and then she's got a loose robe, and even the nightgown, it trains down the stairs. And it looks so beautiful.
I'm so glad that you enjoyed it. Nina just did an incredible job, and I love those movies. One of our big references was The Innocents with Deborah Carr.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember in that movie, there's just long sequences of her wandering around a house in this like big white frilly nightgown with only a candelabra. And that was just on our sort of vision board for so, so long. So we were trying to do the same thing kind of in that sequence with Scotty and her nightgown.
Well, and watching this film of Seance, because to bring all of our listeners up to speed, we've got two couples, you, Lillian, married to George. George was married to Scotty's character of Emma. Emma has now remarried to Albert, who is kind of mamby-pamby. You know, you expect to see a woman as strong as Emma with a man who is equally as strong or stronger than her.
Mm-hmm.
Not somebody who always says, yes, dear, whatever you think. Yes, dear, whatever you think. You're always right, dear. That can get pretty tedious in a marriage, which is why they're having a few little problems. But they all stumble upon each other miraculously at this vacation spot at the beach. And Lillian insists that Emma and Albert come for dinner. George tries to talk everybody out of it. And I'm thinking as I'm watching this, it's like, oh, this is not going to be good. This is not going to be good.
Just nothing weird about having dinner with your ex-husband and his new wife.
Yeah. Nah, nothing weird at all. But everybody ends up at Lillian and George's home for dinner. which quickly escalates. And I don't know if we want to call it escalation or descends into hell.
Sure, yeah, things rapidly start to get strange.
And descends into hell.
Starts to get a little creepy.
So we've got plenty of creepy. We've got bloodshed happening here. We have speaking to spirits. You know, maybe not.
There is some communing with the dead, yes.
Yes. You know, I was fully expecting a cameo appearance from Lynn Shay. You know, our beloved medium in the Insidious franchise. That would have been a great cameo get for you, by the way, to have Lynn up there.
Suddenly it just turns into Blythe's spirit or something.
Yes, you know. Have Angela Lansbury come commune. From the beyond. But so much attention, very character driven, but the film is so well populated with the history of your locations, the set dress, just outstanding set dress with all the accoutrement and all the little things. Everything is so period perfect. We are immersed. I don't know if you shot everything in one house or if you went into different houses, so you can explain that for us. But
yeah,
the house is a character unto itself.
I agree, and I think that was one of the challenges of this kind of film. Like, I scouted like over 30, 40 houses. I mean, basically any house we could find that was remotely around that period. I, you know, would go over, take a look at it, kind of look through every room. And originally we were hoping to find one house, but we ended up shooting in three.
Oh, my God.
And we were able to sort of pick and choose our favorite rooms from each, which was a little hectic, but, you know, but then we obviously got to have, you know, more, I think, it just sort of really maximized the budget on screen because rather than compromise and say, well, we like this house, but the dining room isn't as nice. It's like, you know what? No, let's just pick the best rooms of every house. One of the homes we shot in is privately owned, and it is, if it's not the oldest house in Pasadena, it's one of them. It's one of the original, I think it was built in the 1890s, homes to that area, and it's beautiful, and it has the room where we shot the seance, and that chandelier has obviously been rewired for electricity, but it's original, and it had all of that original wood paneling, which was so beautiful, and that incredible wooden staircase, so... And apparently it does have a ghost, but the ghost did not appear while we were shooting, but
how rude.
But allegedly there is a ghost.
Wow. Well, I have to say, you know, for shooting in different homes, the wood is actually matched up very well, so it all looks cohesive and like it's all in the same house. And it's all it's all that rich, dark wood. And after... Mm-hmm. You know, 150 years, the luster on the wood is just so gorgeous. And this is where your DP, where Joanna's work comes in. She lights and lenses this so exquisitely.
She's incredibly talented.
We get a lot of negative space. And I'm a big fan of negative space when it's used properly. And it's used properly here because you've got fall off on the sides that, you know, give us that negative space. So we don't know. And because of your sound, where we'll hear something scuttling or something, is this Hazel? Is her ghost sneaking around the house? So, you know. The noise, the directional noise that your sound team has done. To have it come in from different speaker, the mix, you know, they're picking the area that the sound is coming from. And that really plays into what Joanna has done with the visuals and the unseen. So that marriage
there is gorgeous.
I'm so
glad you picked up on all of this because all of it wasn't very intentional. And also shout out to our incredible post sound editor, Ryan Gottschall, who, you know, he and I spent a long time, you know, creating that 5-1 mix, and he, you know, I love working with him. I also worked with him on my first feature, Scrap, and he really has a great sense of that kind of directionality and like where things should come from and where it would be more unsettling for the audience to place a certain sound effect. So I love that you were able to sort of notice and pick up on all that. He'll be thrilled.
Well, and it's wonderful because of the fact that you don't have a lot, you don't have a cacophony of sound. The film is actually very quiet. As people are moving about the house. There's not servants. There's not a lot of hubbub. It's very quiet and polite. It was a more polite time. So you're more cognizant when you hear sounds out of the ordinary. And it's 1892. The house, it was built within 10 years of the setting. So you can't say, oh, it's an old house from the 1700s and it's creaking and moving. No, this is very purposeful, and I just love that marriage there of the visual and the sound, and with Joanna's beautiful lighting work,
the lenses we shot on, which I should mention, which was Joanna's idea, were these vintage Super Baltar lenses.
Those are killer.
We chose them because they do have that really beautiful natural fall off, and really, we wanted to emphasize narrowing the aspect ratio instead of shooting it in 2.39, like most modern films, we shot it in 1.85. So it just makes it a little bit narrower and more boxy. And so essentially the characters are trapped a little bit more in the frame and can't quite, see what's around the corner or what's around the edges. And we wanted the audience to have that experience as much as possible as well.
I mean, just so beautifully designed. And of course, then we take a look in Hazel's room. It's very well lit, and the candle glow everywhere. Candle glow is so gorgeous. And the way that sometimes we just have a single candle, as Emma is walking down the hall with the really cool kind of candle holders from days gone by, where you actually have a handle. So you're not having wax drip down on your hand as you're walking through the hallway. But that single light that's flickering, wavering with movement is so gorgeous. And even going into rooms and there's a candelabra with four candles and you pick that up and you walk with it and the light goes with you. It's not a situation where there is a lighting package. So everything is lit. Okay. And you start moving with a candle, but the light's not changing. There's still plenty of light. So why do you even need the candle? So Joanna has lit this so well. That is not what we have here. We feel, 1892 lighting with dark woods, with a house jam-packed with stuff. So that creates even more of a claustrophobic sense.
Lights that had been, like, for the chandelier and the seance had obviously been rewired for electricity, but we were able to take out the electric bulbs inside of the glass sort of fixtures that cover up the bulb. And our production designer was able to put in, with the help of our gaffer, these sort of flickering lights that kind of emulate gas flicker. So we were able to basically have everything either appear to be lit by gas or have all of those practical candles and lamps.
Yeah, I mean, and, with the chandelier, and here it was a great nod to Gaslight, Ingrid Bergman. With the light, the play of the lights, and suddenly lights go out or they go down, and then the sound, as she's hearing, in Gaslight, as she's hearing, sounds above her. And it wasn't until the detective says, and he says, did you see the light go down? Did you hear? And that's exactly what we get here. So as I'm watching Seance, I kept thinking Ingrid Bergman.
Yeah, that was a huge influence on the writing of it. Gaslight, absolutely. The Innocence, which I mentioned before, and then the original Haunting from, I think, 1961, where you never see whatever is haunting them.
Right.
You just hear, there's that famous sequence where they're all kind of in the living room and they're just listening to what's going on upstairs and we obviously wanted to play around with that same idea in the seance sequence. We just thought it would be a lot spookier to kind of create everything with the sound design.
Oh, this was, it's very spooky. It's very spooky, Vivian. You know, where did you...
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Where did you get the idea for this story as a follow-up to Scrap?
Yeah, I mean, right, because it couldn't be more more different. Yeah, for you know, people who don't know, my first feature, Scrap, is set in modern-day Los Angeles, about a woman who's, you know, been laid off and is living in her car, and it's sort of about a brother-sister relationship. And the funny thing is, actually, in 2020, during the pandemic, when I was trying to figure out the financing for Scrap, one of the reasons it was challenging was that Scrap had over 24 locations all mm-hmm. over Los Angeles, and it was just making the budget, you know, it was just sort of inflating the budget, making it more difficult to get the money. So I was sort of thinking, okay, like, what can I write that's just like one location, maybe two locations, you know, something a lot smaller, a lot easier, more intimate. And so I'd kind of been brainstorming about doing something in this genre as sort of a throwback to those like 1940s, 50s, 60s era films mm-hmm. that I've always loved. And then also at the same time, I read an August Strindberg play called Creditors, and it's about a woman who's at a hotel with her husband, who basically runs into her first husband. And there was sort of something about that weird dynamic between the two husbands. I thought that could be interesting fodder for a film as well. So it was, I think, the combination of those things. Maybe there were certain themes from that Strindberg play that I thought could transpose nicely into this kind of gothic Victorian drama. So then I started brainstorming, and then once I kind of had all the characters, I wrote it very, very quickly. It took me less than, I think, 3 weeks to write it.
Oh my God.
It was a pandemic project.
Well, this is a terrific pandemic project. I got to tell you, I am so in love with this film, Vivian, and to see your growth as a filmmaker from Scrap to Seance, wow.
Oh,
wow.
Thank you so much.
And you know, I'm going to notice that because I reviewed Scrap.
Yes, you did. I think you were one of the first ones to
review it. I was, yeah. So.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. That means a lot. And it's been a pleasure to spread my wings a little bit and do something a little more ambitious and, you know, very, very different. And I feel lucky, like, I've been able to do two, you know, very different films. A lot of people get pigeonholed and, you know, are not really allowed to work yeah. in different genres or, you know, even to kind of do a period piece. So I feel very lucky that I got to do two films that were so different back to back.
Well, and, you know, here you think you're going to do something that's easy, one location, you end up with three locations, three different houses.
Right, right.
plus the beach. Exactly. And then you throw in underwater sequences.
Right, right. Yeah.
What
were
you
became,
thinking?
Yeah, what's very funny is that it's what started as such a, in my head, such a simple project. It ended up having a bigger budget than Scrap. So
you think?
It sort of ballooned, yes, because, I mean, you know, once I realized, okay, we're going to go and, well, I don't know, spoilers, but, you know, there is water.
There's a lot of water.
And, yes, and so, like, once we brought in, like, you know, there were stunts and there's underwater and there's, you know, suddenly it was like, wait, this is more complicated than we thought. But even that yeah. was great. I'd never shot underwater before, and we actually had an incredible underwater camera operator named Charlie Wiebert who... that's, you know, one of his specialties. And so he came and joined us for the day, and actually was the operator for the underwater stuff. And it was just fascinating to see how he does that, how he works mm-hmm. that way. It was beautiful.
But you have underwater sequences, you have in the ocean sequences, you know, two women in clothing. Granted, it's nightgowns, but still, they're heavy. They're treading water. You know, they're cotton. Cotton really gets heavy when it gets wet.
Yeah.
For any of the younger
Scotty
audience.
Scotty was joking that she said in our Q&A, we just had our world premiere at Newport Beach. And we
on Friday.
We have an encore screening this Thursday, October 24th at 7:30. If anyone is in the Southern California area would like to come. But she was saying in our Q&A, and then suddenly she was like, now I understand why there's all those like paintings from that time period of like women drowning or like, you know, like, because she's like, you know, yeah, exactly right. Once those petticoats are wet, you really just sink.
Yeah. It's, you know, a lot of people today, because of man-made fabrics and treatments even to cottons and wools, they don't realize the weight of the fabrics back in the 1890s, the early 1900s. That fabric, it was heavy.
Yeah.
And you get water in that, oh, you're going to be hanging that stuff out on the clothesline for weeks to dry.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because even the men wore so many layers. I think Jalone and Connor, who played George and Albert, I mean, I think they're wearing, you know, they sort of have like an undershirt and then they have a white button up on top of that. Then they have a vest and then, you know, they have like a jacket over that. And then they have like a, you know, like a pocket watch and a handkerchief and then a cravat. And, you know, there's so, even the men, there's so many layers and components to how they presented themselves at that time period. We really just don't do that anymore. We all walk around in jeans and a t-shirt.
Yep. Well, and jeans are not fun if you land in the water in those either.
But right.
But it's, you know, not as heavy as jeans in the Levi Strauss initial period. But just on every level, Vivian, I mean, you really challenged yourself with this film. And I think that is something I respect so much. You pushed yourself. And then you are one of the four actors in here. So,
right.
You know, as if directing this, writing this isn't enough, you are one, there are only four actors. You're one of the four. You're one half of a couple.
This is true.
However, most of your scenes are playing opposite Scotty. That I found.
Yeah, she was wonderful to work with.
Most of your scenes are the two of you together. But now, the big question. How well did actor Vivian listen to director Vivian?
She never listens.
Oh,
well, I will say it's funny. I think I didn't realize this until I started directing, but I actually think it's incredibly efficient. And I sort of understand now the appeal of, you know, I think someone like Bradley Cooper and Maestro, and, you know, mm-hmm. it seems like almost impossible when you look at that to say, like, how could you be playing Leonard Bernstein in a biopic of Leonard Bernstein and then also be directing it? But a lot of times as an actor, you don't get much information about kind of the larger world of the project.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found is if you're also the director, you have a huge advantage. Because all of the questions as an actor that you would ask the director, like, what are we going for in terms of tone? You know, how do you want to play this? What do you want to try next? I sort of already knew all of that. So mm-hmm. It's really like I just have an incredible another advantage above the other actors because I have all of that insider knowledge already because I've been prepping the film as the director, you know, for months before mm-hmm. we ever step on set. So I continue to like encourage all of my actor friends to try their hand at directing. It's obviously a lot of work, but I think it makes you a better actor as well.
Now I'm curious, your casting here is so well done, and I have to say that the on-screen chemistry between Scotty and Jalone just leaps off the screen. Leaps off the moment that they say hello on the beach. And they're each there with their spouses. You can feel the electricity between those two. This could not have been an easy film to cast.
No, it was not an easy film to cast. The funny thing is we actually ended up casting Connor first, who plays Albert. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, and then I realized, like, there's just no way I can cast George until we have our Emma. Because whoever, you know, Emma is going to be is really going to inform George. And, you know, we just got so incredibly lucky with both of them. I feel like Jalone, which has this quality, this sort of old school Cary Grant quality that he mm-hmm. can tap into,
yeah.
that a lot of modern actors, male actors, can't.
Right.
Like they can't really relate to the period. They don't really understand how to have that kind of charisma without it feeling very fake and forced.
Yeah.
And he really understands that and was interested. And we had, you know, discussions about even how he held his posture and, mm-hmm. you know, like how he even sort of when to touch her, when not to touch her, how to sort of keep the intention of the character while never breaking the sort of, gosh, what would you say? Like the protocol of that time
right.
period. And then I think Scotty, she to me has a timeless Lauren Bacall quality. She has such, the way that Lauren Bacall did, you know, when she was like 19, making To Have and Have Not. It's like she just kind of came on screen like Athena from Zeus's head, fully formed. And Scotty has that, you know, wry intelligence and, I think she just radiates intelligence on screen. And it needed, you know, she just needed to be able to match Jalone's energy and to be charmed by him, but also to kind of give as good as she got. And She certainly did that. So, this film would not have worked unless all four of us, I think, could believably inhabit the same world, the same time period, be believable as couples, and have that chemistry with each other. And so it was very difficult to cast, but I'm so, so pleased that they all ended up playing the roles they did. I think they're, obviously I'm biased, but I think they're perfect in those roles.
I agree. I think they're perfect. You knocked it out of the park with casting. I mean, just, I wish unfortunately, I have to let you go so I can have my alien country filmmakers come on and I can talk to them.
That sounds fascinating to me.
It's hilarious. Vivian, it is hilarious. But Seance,
I'll have to check it out.
You know, people, if you're in Southern California, if you're down near Newport Beach, check out Seance this Thursday at the festival. And I checked, and there are tickets still available.
Yes, I think we do still have a few tickets available, and I will be there for a Q&A afterwards.
But, you know, don't think this is just a spooky kind of seance thing. We got twists and turns that we're purposely not talking about, I assure you. because when you get the reveals, you're going to go, oh my God. Vivian, job so well done. I am just so
proud. Thank you. That's so kind of you.
I'm so proud of you and what you've done.
Thank you.
You got to come back on the show. We've got to chat some more, talk again, and you got to make another film for me.
Anytime. Yep, that's what I'm working on.
All right. Well, have fun this Thursday at the festival, and hopefully this is going to get picked up and everybody will be able to see it.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Vivian. Bye-bye.
Right, bye.
And that was Vivian Kerr talking seance. Be on the lookout for it. And now, they've patiently been waiting. I'm so excited. Rennie Grahams and Boston McConaughey are with us to talk about the very fun Alien Country. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going. I laughed so hard during this film.
Oh, yay, that's what we wanted.
That was intentional. That was intentional. You're supposed to.
Oh, well, I did. And how can you not laugh at a film where you have an alien named Ben, Demolition Derby, motocross police chase through the desert, some beautiful cinematography of the desert areas, and just characters that are so hilarious. My favorite, I'm going to tell you up front, Barta Heiner is Nana.
We get that a lot.
You know, there's something about an old grandma who takes her vacuum cleaner to vacuum up alien spores. You can't beat that.
She was, people say she did probably the most important job in protecting the planet, and that's cleaning up after the mess. So, which doesn't get covered as much in a lot of these types of films, you know?
That's right. Somebody has to clean it up. Someone has to do it. And, you know, not only does she have her vacuum in the house, she's got a portable one that she can take with her wherever she goes.
That's right.
You know, battery operated. So, guys, where did the idea for this film begin? This is not the kind of story that you're sitting at breakfast one day and the cereal box has nothing interesting to read. And you say, hey, you know what? We should do a movie about aliens and
well,
make it funny.
It's funny that you bring it up that way, because I think that for me, I always wanted to tell adventure stories or stories that you can't just sit down and maybe come up with everything all at once. And that's actually probably really true for this project. In 2014, I first was writing a movie, and the movie itself was designed to be a little bit of just a Western, because we lived in Utah and we loved the Red Rock, the beautiful landscape. But I got about 71 pages into a draft of that script and was like, I don't know what else I'm supposed to put into this modern day Western idea that I have. And then I had the unique opportunity to interview Stan Lee at a comic convention. And I just kind of asked him what his advice for writers were. And he told me that he always wrote stories that he would enjoy reading. And I started to really dig deep and think, well, okay, so what am I missing here? And I looked through all the films that I had grown up watching and fell in love with and realized, well, I love movies that have creatures or monsters or some kind of, you know, supernatural threat to them. And at the time, I was working on a little indie short film in the desert, and I ran into this woman who started telling me all of these incredible UFO stories. And the more I kind of pulled on that thread, the more I realized how much a part of the modern American West was alien culture. So if there was going to be a creature story that we told, it was a modern day Western. Yes, it took a long time to get there, but it became ultimately the alien country idea, you know, and what represents ultimately us and where we were living in Utah at the time.
And as a couple, we were really interested in not just exploring the story of what it takes to fall in love, but what it actually takes to stay in love. And I think you'll find that we explore that theme quite a bit in this movie.
You certainly do. Watching Everly and Jimmy is, boy, that's a love-hate relationship. And it's so fun watching that, watching things shift as the emotions change, and when Everly's in danger and the lengths that Jimmy will go to protect her, to save her. Just wonderful. But the banter and bickering back and forth, Rennie, I got to tell you and Casey are fantastic foils for each other on screen. Just so engaging. And then you throw in Sharon Prabhakar, who plays Alien Ben. And he is just so funny, just standing there. And getting in between the two of you and KC just amps up the funny. It fuels the funny dynamic.
It's interesting you say that, too, because a lot of people ask, you know, actors approach with different, you know, their different lens, their different skills, their different method. And people were like, you know, Ben, how did you come up with it? That's pretty much Charon's character. He is 100% the character you see on screen in real life. And well, some of the other actors found their character. I think Ben and Charon was one that just was, it was just him. So.
And when we were doing table reads with him, he didn't initially come in. His character didn't initially come in until about page 60. And all of our feedback was like, we need more Ben. We need more Ben. So we actually rewrote the movie for him to enter in a little bit earlier than that.
Oh, I'm so glad you did. Because if he hadn't come in till page 60, he would have been gone. He would have been in there for 15 minutes, maybe.
So true.
Exactly.
And I would have been heartbroken because he is so funny. He's so good. And, you know, I love it. Very matter-of-factly, he gets asked, well, okay, why do you look like a human? Why don't you look like these really weird aliens that you are? Well, I'm a good alien, and I wanted this form, and I like this. And it's like, okay, and you buy it. 100%, you buy it, as he says it. And it's just, you don't even question it. He's that good and that believable.
Well, that's good to hear, too, because I think as indie filmmakers, you have a lot of constraints. And, you know, budgetarily, it's like, well, how much can we do with prosthetics or do with visual effects? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it is really nice when you can have someone just carry with the performance the idea behind, you know, what's really going on in the galaxy. So
yeah, you didn't need exposition. Anything that he said just in the course of conversation, you believe it. There was no reason to ever doubt him. Of course, we'd already seen the lovely portal between worlds open up. This is where your money went. This is where your money went, guys. Those effects for the portal between the worlds, which we see more than once, the creatures themselves, this is where your money is. And you can see every dime on screen. Also, with your demolition derby cars, they had to run. So you can go to the junkyard and pick up some junkers, but you still got to make them run. Talk to me about putting all of these. You've got this great story. We've got aliens going to and from. We're not going to divulge why the aliens are coming to Earth, what they're doing here, other than they're really not nice. But for Alien Ben, who's a good alien. So how did you go about approaching this, working with your cinematographer, with Wes Johnson? As I said, your desert shots, the Red Rocks, stunning, 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 integral part of the film. You've got your action sequences. This has a lot of moving parts to it. Walk me through your approach.
Yeah, there was a level of complexity the Alien Country took on that I didn't realize how overly ambitious it was in so many great ways. And I kind of liken it to indie filmmakers feel like hot rodders. You know, they're building cars in their garage. But every so often, you start building a car in your garage and discover that maybe you're actually building a helicopter. And that's maybe what Alien Country became, because we had, like you said, all these vintage vehicles, demolition derby cars. That's literally an old 70s car that somebody, they swap engines in, and they're rebuilding these things so that they can smash them into other cars. Yeah. And if my advice for anyone who wants to go out and make a movie like this is, no, don't do that. Vintage vehicles are the bane of indie filmmaker's existence. But at the same time, you know, with a wing and a prayer, yeah, we got the shots we needed. Like you mentioned, Wes Johnson and I, it was our first project working on together. I had seen his work, and it was a recommendation through a friend. We got to know each other. He fell in love with the script. And I just said, well, okay, it's in your hands. I'm going to try to keep these cars running and keep the movie on the rails. And we really just, anytime something didn't work out, we took every little drop we could out of the footage we shot, and we ended up shooting just to make sure that this film could get finished with the scope it was. We shot 25 days of pickup shots.
Oh, my God.
Which was, yeah, which would really just entail me, maybe one stunt double, an actor, or maybe Rennie and I would go down to the desert, and we'd get just an insert shot that we just needed or missed. And we had 24 days of total, you know, full production. So it took us four long years to just make sure that we got the level of complexity that we started out in the beginning with. And, you know, for better or for worse, it truly is an authentically unique piece, and it definitely represents us in our hometown. So
now I'm curious, because we've got aliens here. Now, did you do any creature creation practically, or was all of the creatures, were they all done through visual effects and special effects?
Yeah, there are a couple. I learned a lot about this, and I could probably, you know, talk about it for a couple of weeks on ad nauseum. But the main alien goes through some metamorphosis, right? So there are these creatures. There's multiple of them in the film, and they can grow. And so what we did do is we started with some practicals, and so there's different levels of practicals. It goes through what I like to say. It starts off at the beginning of the movie, sort of at like a pit bull size. And then it mutates, and then it becomes about the size of a tiger. And then, spoiler alert, at the end, it gets a little bit or a lot of bit bigger. But when we got into those bigger scopes, it was mostly computer-generated. But for any close-ups or insert shots we did, we had these beautiful practicals sculpted by Logan Long and Kelly Donahue, two incredible, talented practical effects and special effects artists. And so they put those together. And I would say that what's really cool about a practical effect is when you get in there for those close-ups on teeth and eyes, if you've done those sculpts, you know, beautifully, there's a level of real, reality that just transcends, I think, what a lot of times can happen at a lower budget CG level like we ended up with. But yeah, a nice blend allowed us to really, you know, shape out and get a ton of bang for our buck when it came to the creatures.
One of my favorite scenes is with one of the puppet aliens on the kitchen table when we first kill one of the first aliens. And literally Kelly Donahue was our puppeteer beneath the kitchen table. And she had this, like, she was like cat's cradle with strings and like pulling these like gills that work in the aliens, and it was spewing KY jelly and syrup or something. And it was just, it was so fun to watch it come to life.
And it, as you mentioned that, immediately, as Boston was talking about the practical creatures that were done, I immediately went to the dining room table scene in my mind. That is exactly what I went to. So it was very funny that that's what you brought up, Rennie. And of course, come on. You can't keep an alien on your kitchen table. Can't do it.
We eat on that table.
So where do you put it?
Yeah, you got to pack it up and put it in the fridge.
In the fridge. Okay. So let's just hope that Nana labeled it properly so that nobody mistook it for another piece of meat in the refrigerator. These things are just so funny, but what's so beautiful, the performances of everyone, all very natural. It's free-flowing, makes perfect sense. It's not like what sticks out more like a sore thumb, and it's supposed to, is our Officer Kirk, who exudes an air of pomposity that is quite something and really doesn't fit in with the rest of the community. So watching him, you might think he is an alien, but, you know, no spoilers, he's not. But, you know, it's the naturalness, the free flow of the dialogue. You've got people very conversational. So it all works so well. But I'm so happy that you were using some practical creatures and then moving into CGI for the rest. Whose idea was it to have them in the Dayglow neon green? The Dayglow neon green ooze.
Yeah, so I think one thing people will say is, especially when you're on a budget, you know, you don't want to show the alien. You don't want to, you only have so much money and it's got to be a great shot. And so they're like, there's more suspense if you don't show it. So we were trying to think of some really creative ways to do that. Uh-huh. And absolutely this idea of, well, what if our creatures were bioluminescent? And that had to make sense for what, I'm a creature nut. So that had to make sense in terms of what the purpose of that bioluminescence was. So we basically said, kind of like maybe a cuttlefish does to hypnotize its prey, these creatures are going to, unlike fireflies who, you know, flash to mate, these are guys who are going to flash to hunt. So it allowed us to be able to have moments where you just see an actor and behind them a green light flashes and the audience knows there's an alien there. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't require us to do anything other than have a practical light on set doing a little lighting gag. So we came up with that idea and then really helped that enhance the story. And just recently, one of our actors, you were mentioning how incredibly natural they were. Mm-hmm. They were asking how difficult it was to perform, you know, without CG, against CG creatures or things that weren't there. And what was really fun is because we had that practical light, their natural performances really came out because they had something that was, you know, that they could interact with a lot of the time. So, yeah.
It was not a tennis ball on a stick.
No.
Now,
or it was literally Boston acting like the creature in while we were acting.
Well, you know, isn't that what a creator is supposed to do to help his cast? Now,
I don't think I would ever be a great actor. Rennie is a wonderful, brilliant actress, and when you see her on screen, she's captivating. I'm more the guy in the suit. You know, I think I could be a creature. I could move around like a monster. That's about the extent of my acting skills, maybe. But yeah. Absolutely a blast to do.
Now, who came up with the idea for the portal between the worlds? That is so beautifully done, and I love the color that comes into play there. You're using the blues, the purples, the mystical kind of colors that are so different than what we're seeing in this small town USA in the desert. I love the exchange of portals and the differential you then have between Earth and alien country and just floating in the cosmos. So
yeah, there,
whose idea
there was
that?
A lot of color design and things we were trying to accomplish. And certainly when it came to just simple, I listened to a lot of like M. Night Shyamalan talking early about Sixth Sense and how simplistic his color design was to be bold and very, you know, clear. And so ultimately, the aliens are generally always represented in green tones.
Mm-hmm.
And then our portal itself, like you're describing, is much more in this blue mm-hmm. tone. The Earth that we see, you know, in and around southern Utah, where this was filmed, is very red. You have red yeah. rock. And we kind of took those three things, that, you know, RGB, that red, green, blue, and we made that the palette that we started with. And then as the world start to meld, you know, as aliens start to be involved with a little bit of the town, you know, we see more oranges, you know, kind of a mixture of yellow and green. And you know, when we go and see some of the extraterrestrial planets, all of a sudden this portal and then the Earth come together. So we have a little bit more purple slide into mm-hmm. this blue green space. So it gets a little abstract, and it's pretty clear when you see it, or maybe people don't think about it. Maybe it's subconscious, but we absolutely wanted to just create something that was so vibrant and fun and poppy. And so rather than making it a brooding, dark film, we wanted this to be comic book. We wanted you to turn the page and all of a sudden you're in green space and you're like, oh, I know what's happening. There's yeah. aliens coming, you know. So that was a lot of the design there.
And the portal itself is something we actually worked on quite a bit in the writing process in terms of how to make the magic system work for it, and how would it make sense with, we have the portal itself, but then we have these portal stones that are actually what's enabling the portal to be opened. And it actually did take us quite a while to figure that system out. And we were playing around with a bunch of different things, like, oh, maybe the key to opening it is having three different people and three different stones. And anyway, it kind of got convoluted and complicated. But at the end of the day, we just loved this concept of opening this portal into different worlds that could ultimately potentially trap you and create some urgency there.
Mm-hmm. I love the whole idea of it only opens for a few seconds and it can trap you in there. And that's built up, and it's so important, so that when Everly goes through a portal at one point, she could be trapped there forever. The stakes, real, you've got some great stakes happening here, especially because Everly is pregnant. And Jimmy is like not too sure whether he's thrilled or not about this. I haven't figured that out yet. You know, do you go after her? Do you try and save her? What do you do? So you really set up, you know, some emotional high stakes at the core of this, because it's not just thrown together. It's people they want to save, maybe not save the planet, but definitely save their loved ones. So I love how you constructed that.
Well, you actually hit exactly on our theme. Our theme for this movie was literally what it takes to become responsible and ultimately protect your family, your town, yeah. and your planet. And that's what Everly and Jimmy have to learn in the process of will they, won't they stay together? And, you know, are they going to be there for their unborn child? And I think in the process, you know, they learn a great lesson. And we see Everly do what it takes to sacrifice herself, if needed, for Nana and for Jimmy.
Yeah.
And we need to see if Jimmy is willing to do the same thing through the end of the movie. And that's something that's really powerful that we hope to convey. So
it definitely comes across, Rennie. And I got to say, you are so kick-ass in this film.
Thank you.
You are the one who's like, come on, let's go get him. You know, when we first meet Everly, Everly's car has broken down. Jimmy pulls up, and the two of you are just batting, combative. It's like, well, I fixed it. Yeah, right. This is how good you fix the car. And, you know, I'm taking off. I'm a singer. I got to go play. And leaves him stranded there. The attitude that you bring is so good. We know right then you're not putting up with anything from anyone, ever. And you maintain that through the whole film. And I really love that, because we see the strength in you. We see the strength in Nana. So we don't have mamby-pamby women here. And you lead that charge and are actually stronger than the men. And I love that. It's great.
Thank you. It's pretty awesome when you get to write your own character. no, but we really, like, we wanted to create somebody who who was tough and was sassy. And frankly, I usually get cast in very, like, edgy parts that are, you know, like the drug addict or the alcoholic. And, you know, I've always wanted to play an action hero, but also balance the, you know, what it takes to become, you know, basically this movie is also about my fears of becoming a mother and like what mm-hmm. what it means to have a career and be a mother. And we wrote that into the story as well. So, but really she sums up her whole journey with her song Now or Never. Like if I'm going to do what I want to do with my life, which is, you know, become a singer, but also have a child and also be with, you know, the man of hopefully my dreams. I've got to do it now or never. So.
And you even get to drive a demolition derby car.
Like I said, when you get to write your own movie.
Now, this, I got to ask Boston. Boston is directing this. You guys have co-written this. Yes, you've written your own character, Rennie. But Boston, did Rennie ever want to go off the rails and change stuff in her character against your wishes?
I would say if she did, she was welcome to. One thing I think, and this was my first feature, but really ultimately the first opportunity I had to work with such incredibly talented actors. You mentioned Rennie's performance, and she's so badass and cool, and just but Ben and Casey Clyde, who's just so brilliant.
Yeah.
He carries the entire movie as Jimmy Walker.
Yeah.
You know, but there's no member of the cast, whether it's Rachel Brooks Smith or Corbin Allred or any of these wonderful actors, who didn't just bring their level of just authenticity. And I learned, you know, this, like I'm saying, my first time directing such incredibly talented people, that they carry those characters. And so as a director, for me, if they generally wanted to step in and say, oh yeah, I think it would be better to do this or say this, I wanted to let them explore that. Because a couple of times I would give a suggestion. I asked, there was a setup where Ben says a line towards the end of the movie that Jimmy says at the beginning of the movie. We do this scene where it's kind of like the same scene happening with different characters doing it as a joke. And I asked the actor, oh, just say it like he said it before. But he wasn't even on set during that other take. And I realized, like, yeah, I've got to let these actors live in their own space, fill the characters their own way. And ultimately that's what made the audience just captivated. And so as a director, it's a little bit less, you know, what do I think the characters need to be? It's once I've given this to this actor, what can we make together?
Mm. Now, because this was your first feature directorial, Boston, what was the learning curve like? What was the greatest thing that you learned about yourself as a filmmaker that you can take forward into your future directorial projects?
I hate this question so much because I have just like tomes of and libraries worth of things I wish I could have done or changed or do better. And so I just kind of have to pick one to say. But I think that the thing that is really interesting for me is, thank goodness this is the first film we made together, Rennie and myself. At this length, at this scope, you know, because you get to do something authentically and uniquely personal with your first film. And it should be, and I heard Mark Duplass talk about that, and it's very famous, his South by Southwest speech called The Cavalry's Not Coming. But it was like, make something that is unabashedly you. And Alien Country certainly is that. I think the thing I would take forward now is I start to understand a little bit more of the business side of film, where you're looking at, and I don't want to just call them boxes, but let's call them canvases of what a film needs to be when it falls into a certain genre. And so if you're making a sci-fi comedy, those are seen often as two different genres. And I think, yeah, ultimately audiences nowadays, because of how media is consumed, they want cross-genre and like complex characters and complex stories, and they don't want to just fit into one category necessarily. But definitely as you're designing a project, trying to fit it, fall into a little bit more of that genre promise and make sure you give the audience everything they're expecting. I think Alien Country subverts a lot of expectations, and I think that was what makes it so strong. But as we go forward, I'm willing to dive deeper into the horror of things, or maybe dive deeper into the cerebral side of things and really deliver on some of, when you think a creature feature, you know, should more people get eaten alive? And I maybe I was a little bit afraid to be too dark with the material or at least go into some of that really crazy stakes. Now, there's people who die in alien country, but the long or short answer, the way too long answer to that is, I'd love to just dig deeper into what the promise of a genre is and make sure that I give that audience exactly what they're looking for and then over-deliver on the rest. So that's kind of the thing I've learned with this film.
Now, Rennie, I'm really curious for you, how, because you've worked with multiple directors in your acting career, how would you describe Boston as a director?
Boston takes the material and he lives and breathes it in such a way that I have so much trust for him. Granted, we've been working together as producers and content creators for 14 years now. So I just have the ultimate trust for him. So I have to admit that sometimes when I'm on set with other directors, I have a tiny bit of a defense mechanism go up just because I want to trust them as much as I trust Boston. I know that when I'm working with Boston, I'm going to get the best performance possible. He also knows me really well, so he doesn't let me BS through anything. He calls me out on my BS, but I also know he's going to not only drive home the acting takes, but he's got such a sharp eye for cinematography because he's shot so much of his own content in the mm-hmm. past that I just know ultimately at the end of the day we're going to get an amazing, beautiful product. And so there's just a huge amount of trust there that we've developed for working together for basically 14 years at this point.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm curious about working with your the editing on this and the pacing that you have. This is perfectly paced, guys. Which it's so hard with comedy action. You know, it's always a slippery slope when you're in the editing room and you've got to come up with a consistent pacing of the film. How challenging was the edit of Alien Country?
It was definitely one of the biggest hurdles, I think, for the film. You know, and it's interesting because we showed different cuts over the years as we were still doing pickups or as we were still adding this or that. And it's surprising to hear people say how when they see this final product, they're like, I was blown away. Because when you sent me that rough cut, boy, I was worried. You know, but for me, I grew up editing since I was 11 years old. I'm 38 now. So the type of ways we were editing back in the day onto VHS tapes or whatever it was, you know, I've really grown up speaking that language. But I had an incredibly talented assistant editor, Keenan Panty, who did a great job finding the performance, finding the moments. And then overall, when you talk about the pacing, ultimately, we wrote the film to be really tight. And we wanted mm-hmm. to approach it because Rennie and I got our start on YouTube. We were saying, could we give at least 80 or 90% of the pacing we found worked on YouTube and cram that into a 97-minute film? Mm-hmm. And while that was a little bit crazier, ambitious, and frankly, for some audiences, it might be a little too fast-paced. We got a little bit of that feedback. I think it does help really make this movie something that captivates. And we hear people say, yeah, you know, when you sent me the link, I was like, well, I'll start it, but I'll probably go to bed because it's already, you know, 12:30 at night. And she's like, well, then I went to bed at 2:30 and watched your entire movie from start to finish. You know, and it is cool to hear that because we really wanted to keep just, there's so many cuts and pacing with this. It actually is probably about, I heard the colorist complain because he was like, when you said a feature, I didn't know it was going to have over 200, you know, 2,500 shots. And
oh,
I guess that's more than average. So anyway, but it's a tight movie and it really, you know, keeps the beat up.
It definitely stays high energy. You don't shortchange the themes that you have happening. You don't shortchange on the action or the comedy. You really do. You have hit all of the beats for each of those elements so that it is. But when it was over, I didn't realize that an hour and a half had gone by. It's so entertaining and it moves so well. And that's what's going to keep your audience engaged and that's what's going to have them standing up tonight at your premiere up in Glendale.
Yeah, we're so excited. I mean, first and foremost, to hear you say that, that's what we made it for. We made it so that, you know, if you enjoyed it, it means the world. And the more people we can find who found that and enjoy it, yeah, that's everything a filmmaker wants. And so, yeah, we're up at Glendale at the Look Cinema tonight doing an incredible LA premiere of the film. And then tomorrow it's off. It's available for purchase, and this film is out. We have an incredible distributor, and so Alien Country's coming.
Yeah, I know. Scott had asked me, did I want to come tonight and cover your red carpet? And I wish I could have, but logistically, I wouldn't be able to get there in time with other things that I've got this afternoon. But yeah, I would have loved to have been there tonight with you guys for this LA premiere. But I'm so happy that come tomorrow, it's all the digital and streaming platforms. You've got iTunes, Apple, Amazon, Google Play, Fandango, Vimeo, DirecTV, Dish, Cable, VOD. Everybody can see Alien Country tomorrow. And they should, because they're going to love it. It's so much fun. And
yeah,
right now we need fun movies. Tis the season for fun.
It's the season for fun, and it's a not so scary scary movie, you know.
Right.
So
just in time for Halloween.
Yep.
If you like alien movies, I would say go see Alien Romulus with your spouse, but watch Alien Country with your kids, because it's definitely designed to fit most all ages. You know,
yeah.
It probably should be maybe closer to the teenage years, because it is a little bit scary, but it's a not so scary scary movie.
You know, I think you could even do like 10 or 11 years old. And I think
we're finding the cutoff seems to be around 9, depending on the kid.
Guys, job so well done. So much fun. Are you going to do another feature?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we have several that we're making. There's a couple projects in that could be a great spiritual successor to Alien Country in a sci-fi horror space. Or, you know, more of the sci-fi, cerebral, you know, dark thriller space. But also, yeah, we want to make movies for the rest of our lives. So you ain't seen nothing yet.
Darn good thing, because I like what I've seen and I want more.
Oh, thank you so much.
Guys, thank you so much. This has been so wonderful. And have fun tonight.
You too. Thank you. We're sorry we're missing you, but we appreciate this so much.
Oh, my pleasure. When Scott reached out to me about, and I'll cover anything for Scott. You've got a great publicist on this one, let me tell you.
We're so happy.
Guys, thank you. And I hope we will chat again in the future.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks
Looking
so much.
To it.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
And that was Rennie Grahams and Boston McConaughey talking about Alien Country. Hey, if you're in Glendale, you can catch the LA premiere tonight. Otherwise, everybody can see it tomorrow on just about any platform out there. And it's a lot of fun. And it's perfect for October and Halloween month. So that is all the time we have today. Yes, we're late. And next week, she's back. Jane Clark returns, this time talking about her feature film, Witchy Ways. Halloween week, you gotta have a film with a witch. We got it next week. Witchy Ways, Jane Clark will be with us live talking about that. So, until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.